You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
Is there going to be Civil War II? I mean, the thought would have been ridiculous to me even a few years ago. But last year, I actually heard smart people on both sides of the aisle. This is not political. On both sides, people were saying, oh, we're going to secede if this happens, if XYZ happens. And again, I heard this from Democrats. I heard this from Republicans. I heard this from Libertarians. But what happens if there's a Civil War too? So I brought on Clay Martin. He's a former Green Beret. He's been there, done that. He's seen Civil Wars in action. He wrote a book, Prairie Fire, Guidebook for Surviving Civil War II. Here's Clay Martin to tell us how to do it. Clay, you wrote a book about prepping for Civil War II. It's called Prairie Fire. This comes after your book, Concrete Jungle. I forgot the subtitle of that one.
Green Beret's Guide to Surviving Civil
War. Urban Survival.
Urban Survival. Yeah, that's right. Yep.
So, you know, I wonder about this because, look, I think about Seattle last year where they had the CHOP or the CHAZ or whatever.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the CHAZ. Yeah.
Like, you know, I'll do proper introductions for you and everything, but yeah. The CHAZ really bothered me. Like, this completely autonomous zone was taken over by God knows who. The mayor said it was like an arts festival, and teenagers were actually dying.
Yeah.
Like the children of parents were dying in this, and they wouldn't let ambulances in. They wouldn't let the medical people in, and nobody got it. And then when they said, we're going to take over the mayor's house, she ran tanks through it and ended the whole thing. And now the main guy who was running that is like selling t-shirts online. Like, why wasn't anybody charged for that?
Man, that's the world that we live in. I mean, that's part of like the slippery slope of like disaster is the fact that that was allowed to happen basically for political gain. That one's really bad. Ironically enough, there's one happening in California right now that's kind of like the opposite. It's like some super right-wing dudes that basically declared this two little town area is like seceded. And nobody's really doing anything about that one either. But the CHAZ one, I'm kind of with you, that really bothered me as well. Simply because, like you said, it was like a New Amsterdam on steroids. Like they got away with whatever they wanted in there, and people paid for it. That was really weird, and it's also, you know, contrary to what we would think of both the state and federal government doing in a situation like that. It was really bizarre.
But there's obviously we've seen a lot of bizarre things, and some of it done with good intentions, some of it I can't understand. Like okay, you know. Economic lockdowns, there's a lot of debate about it.
Right.
If you have a pandemic going, you know, I'm not a doctor, I don't know what the medical is, but you would see like furniture stores closed, which never have anybody in them. And downtown, there would be a 20,000 person protest, but I guess somehow COVID wasn't going to be transmitted in those. So those were allowed. So I couldn't understand what was the consistency of anything. And maybe that's where what is Civil War II? Like, how is that going to happen?
That's open to debate because there are a lot of ways that it can go down. All those things that you were just talking about, that's really, I think, the first time that we've seen protests happen on that scale. And they weren't even riots. Let's call them what they were. Purely for political gain. And basically what I came to the conclusion of probably about mid-July of 2020. I mean, that was actually a well-funded color revolution. All that BLM stuff that started was the beginning phases of a color revolution that was in...
What do you mean by color revolution?
Color revolution is this term that loosely means... We started this in the early 90s. It was kind of like using a nonviolent, mostly, protest movement to overthrow a government. And it worked in a lot of ways because, you know, in the 90s starting, they wouldn't really let you like machine gun protesters anymore. World opinion would instantly turn against you. So you could get away from that. You could go to kind of this pseudo, we break things, but we don't really, you know, hang the president, for instance, from a lamppost style. Of
why is that called a color revolution? Like, is that named after like practice revolutions in the military? Or
no, not at all. It was just I don't even really know who came up with the term, but it was like the Orange Revolution in Ukraine in 92. And a lot of times it had to do purely with some color that was picked to represent, like, we want to overthrow this, so we're wearing orange armbands or purple or whatever. And this kind of became known as color revolutions. And we were behind a lot of those. It's kind of like what our government does.
Right. So you're saying, BLM, again, all these things I feel start with good intentions, but as
yes,
a lot of people know, even when I was talking to Eric Adams, who's now the mayor of New York City, I was talking to him right after or during the BLM, and he said there were other forces that intermingled or mixed in.
Yeah, big time.
And like bricks would show up at different parts of the city
right
simultaneously all of a sudden. And those weren't the protesters, but there were groups mixed in. Like, and he never, nobody ever explained like who those groups were. Maybe people didn't know. I don't know. But like all of these things together, like, is this like what happens?
That's actually a hallmark of a color revolution. Cause a lot of times you don't have, like, if I'm a little, you know, Langley CIA nerd or whatever, and I want to go over to Ukraine and have a color revolution, there has to be a legitimate grievance to start with. I can't just go in and mass make up half the country to freak out and have a protest over nothing. It helps immensely if there was a legitimate grievance there to start with, or a felt legitimate grievance. And I really think it's where the BLM thing went. I mean, I think a lot of those people, when they started protesting, they had a legitimate grievance, like, hey, we want to bring awareness to these things that are happening. And then it was, yeah, exactly, it was rapidly hijacked by, to some degree, criminals. Just people that were just there to loot things and, you know, make some new TVs and Nikes. More nefarious, you started to see this like level of command and control that told you there was a lot of money behind this. I was actually just speaking in town where I live about this in a meeting the other night. If you knew what you were looking for, you could watch from up top and see these little, usually cars with some kind of marking on top of them. A lot of times they're just little white Corollas. They were driving around the protest and they were coordinating things. And then you would also see a lot of these elements, there would be like two or three main agitators up front. And they were kind of the guys that were in charge. And this kind of goes back to human nature too. If we just have a mob and we're out there and we don't really know, we're milling about and we got signs and we're angry, but we're not really focused. It doesn't take a lot to focus that mob and then kind of have the mob mentality take over and do your bidding. You could see that in pretty much every protest that happened last summer. And it's very ironic also that it was a BLM protest, Black Lives Matter. It was almost always led, the first brick was always thrown, the first Molotov, by a little college-age white guy, almost every time.
Yeah, at one point in New York, they arrested like two lawyers or two people working for a law firm.
Yes.
Who threw a Molotov cocktail at a police car.
Right.
And this will be the last question I ask on this, but yeah, like that St. Louis guy, like a retired cop was trying to stop people from robbing a
pawn shop.
A TV, a pawn shop in a mostly black community. Mm-hmm. And he was shot on video. It's on YouTube. It's horrible to watch.
Yep.
Shot and killed. You see him bleeding out and you hear the guy saying, I didn't mean to do it. I didn't mean to do it. That guy is clearly identifiable. Like, mm-hmm. Why didn't they catch that guy?
Because they didn't want to. You know, that's really where this comes down to. That's also why, especially in retrospect, you can look at this as all a coordinated effort to kind of try and overthrow the government. because all the charges went away, because that was such a good lead up to, this is scary times now. Oh, now we're going into this election season and you really want this to continue. And it's kind of part of what the mobs and violence is about anyway. It's about scaring people, normal people, so you have an undue influence at the ballot box. All those riots stopped about September, and we haven't heard from them since in any kind of major way, except for the trials of Derek Chauvin and the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse.
So obviously these are things that put the phrase civil war on, you know, that used to be like a crazy phrase.
It
the U.S. can't have a civil
Absolutely.
War.
Right.
But when people like, you know, for instance, Tucker Max, who we both know, when he was, I was having lunch with him shortly after all that, and he was saying it could happen. This was before all the doomer optimism stuff that he has out now. Like, what's going on? Like, why has this become like an acceptable phrase, and how could this actually happen? I'm scared.
Well, I am too. Let me go and throw that out there too. The people that want a civil war the least in this country are the people that have fought an away game war, because we've seen what it looks like. And to think about that happening in our own streets, like just the scale of destruction and death and things that I like I like air conditioning. I like having my trash taken out by the trash. Like, those are all great things. But for us that have seen it, like, we want that the least. Now, how could it happen? Man, you're right. 3 years ago, even saying that was like a nut bar conspiracy theory, like instantly, like we're done talking phrase. But now, I mean, even you look around at like mainstream media, like there are a lot of people that have said the words civil war is coming, national divorce is another way for them to phrase it. You know, mainstream guys are saying these kinds of things. I think even Tucker Carlson has uttered the words, you know, national divorce. So it's on everybody's mind, and that should also be an indicator that it's a lot more back in the realm of possibility. Now, how does it actually shake out? That's a tough one. There are a lot of ways that a country can slide into a civil war. I think a lot of people, when they initially think the word civil war, they think, you know, 1860, like, you have some guys in blue, I got some guys in gray, and we're going to meet on the battlefield and fight it out. That's probably like a lot less likely in the modern world. We'd probably be closer to something like the Croatian Civil War. Croatia in 1991, you know, the wall fell, communism was all dying. They want to break away from Yugoslavia. So it starts as like some riots and stuff, and then it becomes some small scale like guerrilla fighting. Closer to crime, really, than like combat. They're not like shooting artillery at each other yet, but like they're going to go over here and burn down this this Slavic business, and they're going to come back and burn this Croatian, you know, neighborhood. And that goes back and forth for a while. That's probably the most likely case for us. And then it finally escalates, and they eventually break away like a section of territory. Like, this is ours now, and we're a new nation.
Like a bigger autonomous zone of like what we saw.
Much, much bigger. It took them about 3 years.
So what's the sequence of events that could trigger anything here? And of course, your book is about how do we fight it, but how do we survive it?
Right.
And that's what I'm like, I don't want to fight in anything, but I do want to survive if
right.
things go bad.
Well, on top of which, you know, it's funny that it would even be illegal for me to say this is how we win it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that gets right back into like the Treason Act, that kind of thing. But survive it is a big piece. And
but what's the sequence of events that could like even lead to it right here?
Well, like I said, there's multiple ways for this to go. The one that I covered in the book obviously didn't happen yet. I saw the fact that the election would probably be contested coming about July, and I think a lot of other people did too. Like, we knew this was not going to be a normal sequence of events, but I also didn't think that it would be as maybe blatantly screwed up as it was. So one of the ways that it could have gone, and still could go after the 22 or the 24, is most likely action of events. Like I said, this is not 1860. I don't think that a state's going to be like, that's it, we're out of the Union, we secede, like South Carolina did. if for no other reason, that's been kind of settled by Lincoln Doctrine. Like, you can't leave because we'll send dudes with bayonets to make sure that you don't leave. But it is very easy for, especially a coalition of states, let's say like Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, Missouri, and Arkansas, to say after the 24 election, like, that was in no way legit, and we do not recognize that government that's sitting as the rightful government of the United States, and now we have a government in exile over here with our guy. That's a much more likely scenario.
And then, of course, you know, the U.S. government will respond. And by the way, I'm not saying this is a good thing or a bad thing.
It's just a thing.
But yeah, it's just a thing that could happen because it was scary around election time. You're right.
Right.
So the U.S. government could respond and say, listen, we're sending in troops and you're not doing that.
Right. And those states are like, no, you're not. And it doesn't take cruise missiles to start a civil war. You know, that can merely be as much as, okay, just like we did do at the end of segregation, and we're sending the 82nd Airborne to your state, and they're going to take over your state house. And then, like, you have some protesters, and those guys show up, and then there's a pushing match, and then somebody starts pulling the trigger. That's how things escalate. That's how the cycle of violence starts. And it's easy to start, and it's very difficult to stop.
And so at this time, like, what's happening in terms of infrastructure? Is electricity being cut off? Is water being cut off? Is gas being cut off?
Very probably. I mean,
you talk about like phase one, phase two, phase three.
Right.
Like, it's in the phase two area where things, or beginning of phase three, things start to shut down.
Right. And I mean, that's something that was talked about and not ever executed during coronavirus. Around about July, Trump, being in the White House at the time, talked openly about the idea of we might have to shut down interstate travel. We might have to have all the states, like, you know, close off their borders, which is pretty crazy. But yeah, that's an easy way for it to start. That would be actually, you know, a very good U.S. government, federal government response to a state, especially a landlocked state, saying, we don't recognize you anymore. Like, okay, well, we blockade you then. And now nothing goes in or out. So yeah, and depending on what kind of state you have, what's made locally, that could be very bad. I mean, even if you think that you make a lot of things in your state, the modern world, as we've seen over this process, is more interwoven than I think I would have appreciated 2 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was scary to realize how much of our goods, how many of our goods were made in China when all this started.
Oh, wild.
Like, I didn't realize that everything was essentially made there. Like, even food that we grow here is sent there to be packaged and then sent back.
Right, which is absolutely nuts.
And our drugs, our pharma drugs are all made there.
Oh, that's terrifying. As well as, you know, precursor chemicals for our refineries. We always think of ourselves as making a lot of fuel in the area where I'm at. Well, that's great. We do have a lot of refineries. We can make a lot of gas, but only in some cases if we can get the magical chemicals from China. So
yeah,
it's really wild how much that's true.
So let's say I'm in my house and suddenly I'm a little nervous. Oh, the electricity is going to shut off, or the water is going to shut off.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you start preparing for these things? And I feel like you can't really prepare for things in a worst case scenario, but maybe I'm wrong.
Right. No, I mean, you make a very good point there. To me, that's kind of like tactical level prepping. That's like, okay, what do I need to, you know, fill up my bathtub and have some beans in a bucket and that kind of thing. And that will get you through like the initial couple of days or couple of weeks. The biggest theme that I wanted people to take from both books actually is that you can't do it by yourself. Like, Jimmy or Clay or whatever is not going to be fine in my house with like my stuff that I use my Visa card to acquire. And I use myself as an example for that a lot of the times. Like, I was a 15-year special operations guy. I have done all kinds of like Commando Steve ninja stuff. And I can't do this by myself. Like, there's not a chance. Like, I got to sleep sometimes. I can't even handle security alone at my house for an extended period of time because I'm going to take a nap. Like, this is how it is. Honestly, the best way is you've got to get a group of people together that have hopefully a wide variety of skill sets and start thinking this through. And as much as you can, you solve your logistical problems. Like, okay, I got a water filter and I got a water source over there. If I live in a wet area, it's not a big problem. If I live in like Arizona, well, that's the first problem. Like, that's number one. I got to have like 10,000 gallons stored somewhere or a well that's capable of producing something. But yeah, it's a lot more about the long-term survival than it is the short-term survival, I think.
So, a well seems like, or a well or connection to someone with a well seems, or some water source seems important. What about electricity, gas, stuff like that? I guess a generator, your own generator.
What are you going to feed it with? This should be the horrifying thing. When it comes right down to it, electricity and fuel are the rarest commodities that there are. Now, I will also say that having seen this in the Balkans and the Middle East, you know, Iraq especially, right after the invasion, when we took like all their power offline and their ability just a couple of years later to bring power back, it's kind of a mixed bag. Think about electricity. Where's your power made? That depends where you live. Like for us in the region that I live in, we have a very robust grid and there's a power plant 5-6 miles away from me that makes the power for our area. We still have a lot of very small power plants. For people in some parts of the country that have a major power plant that's, you know, 300-400 miles away, or California for that matter, trying to bring electricity in from Texas during the whole Enron debacle, there's not going to be any power. There's none. And you can circumvent that to a degree by having, you know, super robust solar and a battery bank. But that's a really big dice roll. If for no other reason also, then you've invested this huge amount of money in something that you can't take with you and can easily be taken from you. The fuels bit, like once again, using the Iraq example, people think that Iraq had a lot of fuel. Well, they did. They had a lot of raw crude oil, but they did not have a lot of refining capacity. So, man, I want to say gas was up to like, we're talking like 2006, 2007, when we're paying like $1 a gallon, $2 a gallon. They were paying like $5 and $10 per gallon, all on a black market, all some dude on the side of the road that, I don't know, stole some fuel off a fuel convoy or got some of the one that dribbled out of that refinery. And I mean, they're lucky to get 5 gallons. So fuel is that's a massively bad issue. And you go to this whole rabbit hole too of like, okay, if I live near enough farmers, I can make biodiesel. But it's just basically when you have to plan on there not being, I think.
So I guess I know one guy who does solar power, and during the summer months and spring months, he has 100% of his power taken care of by himself. And then in the winter months, he's got about 50%. Mm-hmm. And I asked him if he had to store his power. He said he could store just a couple days worth only.
The ability to store power is like prohibitively expensive. You start talking about, you know, fuel, or what do they call them? Wet cell batteries and all this other crazy stuff to actually store power for any length of time. I mean, those things are like $1,000 per battery, and that won't last that long. It's not that many watts. It becomes a huge issue for us as modern people. And you think about simple things like refrigeration, like, you know, how many people's, you know, preparation plan, like, okay, everything's going to fall apart. Well, I've got 2 deep freezers full of meat. Well, if power goes out, like that's done, unless it's wintertime and it's going to be spring eventually. It's a dark subject.
So when people say, oh, I have my own generator, what does that mean? Where are they getting the power from?
Right. I mean, I've actually got a generator. It's a very common thing in our area. This house I just bought actually has one attached to the house. It runs off natural gas. It's great. It instantly kicks on if the power goes out. But once again, you know, that's not a real prep plan. That's like a nice to have thing if a storm hits and we lose power for 3 or 4 days. That is not a long-term solution to anything. With anybody else, if it's not one of those, it's a little generator that you fill up with a gas can. Like that's not a realistic plan to have electricity.
So what would you do if like power was out for an extended period of time?
It is going to suck. That's all there is to it. There is.
What'd they do in Iraq? Like, what did the people do for years?
Looked at the wall, like burned burned either propane from a little canister or animal dung to make their food. They didn't have lights. I mean, you could live without electricity. It's not fun. It's not a great time. I mean, especially like the area I live in is brutally hot in the summer. I mean, miserable. You're just going to have to take it. I mean, that's it.
And then what about in terms of like food? Like how much should you prepare to have food in advance? Like even canned food, maybe not frozen food, because like you say, the power could go out, but even canned food, like what would a responsible person have in storage?
I really like to have a year, and two is better, but neither of those is actually like 100% true. I can't remember if we cover this deeply in the book or not, but a lot of other people are not preparing. So, you know, to think that I'm going to have my 2 years of food and I'm going to sit in my house in the middle of town and you know, cook beans and rice while everybody else is starving to death is incredibly unrealistic. Like, that's not going to happen.
You make a really interesting point in the book that you should buy, if you do like do a lot of buying of food to store up, you should do it out of town so people don't know.
Oh, yeah.
That you have all the food. But at the same time, you should also buy local so everybody's your friend.
It's a catch-22. And that's like a lot of things in the prepping arena. Like, yeah, I think you should have all the food you can lay hands to right now. But the bigger deal is to have a group of people and have them also thinking about buying the food. I guarantee you some of that is going to get siphoned off. It may be bribes. It may be a method of keeping some people that you don't even really like that much, but keeping them kind of like on your side so they don't burn your house down in the middle of the night. I mean, food is an issue that I think Americans really can't appreciate, like how desperate people will get for food. Like, and you take one of these soccer moms that, you know, has the coexist bumper sticker and is a nice lady in the world, like, when her children start starving to death, like, she will cave your skull in with an axe for a can of SpaghettiOs, like, without question. I mean, horrible, horrible things happen in famines. We've seen this all over the world and all throughout history. It's happened in China. It happened in Ukraine. It happened in Russia during one of their starvations. I believe it was China where they would trade babies so they didn't have to eat their own when it came to cannibalism.
Ugh, like, gosh.
Yeah, it's bad, man. It's
what's the worst thing you've personally seen? Like, you were in the Green Beret and you've been involved in a lot of different actions. Like, what's the worst thing you've seen?
Oh, man, hitting a torture cell house. You know, that was one of the things that various terrorist organizations really, you know, specialized in, was capturing somebody and, you know, drilling their knees out with a Black & Decker and all kinds of other, like, terrible, terrible shit. And even showing up in the aftermath of one of those is stomach turning.
Ugh. And like, obviously everybody's seen torture in the movies.
Yeah.
But what's the difference between real life and the movies in that?
It's not going to stop, and the good guys are not going to show up to rescue you, and you're going to die a horrible, horrible death. And I mean, it's almost unthinkable. I mean, it's to the point that, like, I mean, we had standing agreements amongst each other, like, I will shoot you in the head if we're going to be captured, you, my friend. And I would expect you to do the same for me. That's no way to go out.
Ugh. Yeah, I forgot. I remember reading a couple weeks ago how Gaddafi was killed. And
oh,
I forget now the details, but it couldn't have been worth it. His entire life just added up to that at the end.
Yeah, he should have pulled a grenade out and done himself. I mean, I'm sure he would have at any point in that event. It's bad. And that's also a reason that a civil war is so scary. Civil wars, almost without exception, featured more of that style of brutality than a regular war does. For what reason?
Why is that?
I don't know. I mean, to some degree, people feel more like they're fighting traitors than enemies. And it's a lot easier to do terrible shit to a traitor, someone that should be on your side but has not. It's more personal, typically, also, because both sides, you know, families are involved and they become targets. It just is.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, I, of course, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long, and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you could try it for free at ziprecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast, and the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium-iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
I would say the number one thing you seem to be suggesting is find your crew, find your the group of people,
man.
Whether it's neighbors or people in your area who you have who have your back and you have their back, and you're kind of like, you know, people would rather pick on an individual than a group of what seem like organized people. But what other types of preparation should one do, or should or how should I be thinking?
We should be,
and not just me, but like anybody. And by the way, let's say the odds of this are like close to zero. They're still greater than they were, I feel, 10 years ago.
Me too. Well, and that goes back to, you know, one of the points is like, don't like cash out your 401k yet and buy, you know, generators and night vision goggles. Now, that's good advice right now on, you know, January of 2022. Is that good advice in May of 2022? I don't know. There may come a time where you want to spend everything you've got on preparation work, but also don't think about buying your way out of trouble. Think about being mentally prepared, physically prepared. You know, fitness is a huge deal for both, you know, surviving injury and your ability to take, you know, mental kind of punishment. It makes you harder to kill in general in a fight. And it also makes it so you can stay up longer. You can take more punishment overall. And I guess probably the biggest thing about fitness is it also builds mental toughness. Every time you go to the weight room when you didn't want to, or run a mile when you didn't want to, you're building mental toughness. And that's going to be the biggest thing that we're going to need if this does go hot. Now, as far as the other piece of your question, like what should you be doing? Again, I cannot overemphasize enough that having a tight group of diverse friends that have different skill sets, also building those relationships now while there's not really a problem. It's any relationship that you build after things start falling apart is suspect. You know, if I show up, we've never met before, and I'm like, hey, I broke down in your town during the middle of this crisis and I noticed that you're eating. Well, I'm an ex-Ranger commando and I'll protect your house if you give me some of your food. Can you really trust that relationship? No, it's built on necessity, and it may be built on lies. Like, you don't know.
So, I mean, it seems like there's nothing really to do. I mean, most people are not, like, I appreciate the part about, you know, find your group, but most people are not going to build kind of like a community of friends who will protect each other. You know, they're already in their communities. They're already in their neighborhoods.
Well, that's fine. I mean, do you have friends where you live?
Yeah, but okay. I mean, I just moved here, so I'm just getting to know people.
Well, you got to work on it then, and that is one of the things though. Like having friends, and I don't care what they do for a living. Like I don't care if they're all, you know, some kind of weird thing. I don't care if they're all pacifists. Still having that group of friends that you've met in real what we call meat space. At least you have a real relationship with them. And at least they're close enough also to influence things when things do go bad. You know, the power goes out like nationwide today from an EMP strike or whatever. You don't have any more friends that are 20, 30 miles away from you. Like those people don't exist in many ways. Unless you've built some elaborate plan to take your family and walk out there with your backpack, they don't exist. Now, the, you know, vegan tattoo artist that didn't want to have a gun, she does exist and you know her. There's still value in that relationship, all right? Those are still people that you can rely on. Those people also that even as things go on, you can train to be more and more reliant. So no matter what, having like people is important.
And then what skills do you think, like for instance, I always ask this, like if, and this is related, like if you were transported to 1000 AD, like, you know, King Arthur's court or whatever, what could you do to convince them to let you live? I feel I could do. No, I can't even plug in this microphone before a podcast. Like, what am I going to do? I have no skills. I have no real world skills.
I immediately not die of dysentery. You know, I don't know.
Like, you could be a combat guy. Like, they always need more knights of the round table and stuff. Well, like, you could.
How good am I against those guys since I've spent most of my life working with a firearm and they've spent most of their life working with their hands or a sword? Like, I'm not sword fighting those guys. Like, that is not happening. So, yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. You have to use the time that you have now to build some of those skills if you didn't have any. Like, those guys, I would probably, like, grease myself up in some mud and, you know, jump one of them from this in a way that they wouldn't see it coming because they weren't big on ambushes and kind of work my way in. For somebody else, you do have time right now. And I don't know how much time you have. It might be 2 weeks, might be 3 years, but you've got to at least start working on the basics of, like, how to defend yourself. That should be, you know, way high up the list. How to, you know, cook, how to prepare food, or excuse me, store food. How to, you know, cook that on, you know, twigs that I can gather up in the park. One of the big things I'm going to say for anybody that lives in, like, a major metro area is you should be thinking about leaving. Is that those are the worst places to be when supplies are cut off or the fighting starts.
Yeah, or at least not necessarily leaving beforehand, but having an exit plan. Like, I lived right next to the World Trade, the Ground Zero, the World Trade Center on 9/11.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, there was a debate, like, what if we really needed to leave and there was no way to leave? Like, that, because Manhattan's an island.
Right.
So that was something that was, you know, a conversation then. But yeah, because that could, you know, cities that are in war could be, you know, breeding grounds of disease, dysentery, all that kind of stuff.
Right. And they're going to run out of, supplies first. I think that an average city, like a big city, is usually kept supplied for like 3 days at a time. You count like all their warehousing, all the stuff in the grocery stores. The humongous ones, like New York City, I would think it's less than that. I would think it may be even like a 24 to 48 hour cycle. As well as, I mean, New York is actually, I will say, like, arguably the worst place to be in the entire world when, like, things go badly. For that reason, it's so big. All right, the chain is, or the supply chain to keep it alive are so small, as well as some of the, you know, the other, like, New York-isms, you know, living in smaller houses and, you know, shopping every day. Is that still a thing that New Yorkers do? They shop for dinner stuff like every day at the bodega or whatever.
Yeah, or they order. I mean, I do this still, and I don't live in New York right now. I order from Uber Eats every night.
Right. Okay. Well, you know, either way, that's not going to work anymore, obviously. And the people that typically shopped, you know, more European style, like, okay, I'm going to stop at the bodega on the way home and get the stuff for dinner, like, that's not going to work anymore. So that makes it, in many ways, like, the worst place in the world to be.
So what's the fastest way to learn? And this is like, I know these are like dumb questions, but like,
no, they're not.
What's the fastest way to learn how to defend myself? Because even if you take, like, I don't know, martial arts at the local martial arts center,
right,
you're just learning what the, you know, right. You're not really learning a real world situation.
Right. I've actually thought about this quite a lot because this was a question that came to me a lot right after the pandemic started. So all of a sudden, a lot of people that had never once considered their own safety were very much considering their own safety. That was also one of the ways that you knew things were really weird. You had a lot of people that hated guns, all of a sudden showed up at the gun store like, I'll take that one. Like,
my business partner, his whole family owns pawn shops, and he said gun sales were just through the roof.
Oh, right. Crazy. Absolutely crazy. So I would say this. Start with something, a tool that you can use right now that's super cheap. Go to Home Depot and buy a Vaughn roofing hammer. Basically, it's a hammer on one side and a hatchet on the other. All right. That's probably the easiest weapon in the entire universe to use. Because you instinctively, you know how to hit a nail, or you know how to swing a drumstick. It's the same thing. Could it be argued that a hatchet is not the best defensive weapon because I can get inside of it with a nail, so they're like high-speed ninjas? Yeah, okay. Yeah, probably, but it's good enough. So go get you a hatchet. It's also not so big that you're going to, you know, hang it in the doorway as you're trying to swing it at somebody. As well as, like, psychologically, it still kind of counts as an impact weapon. And from a psychological perspective, for somebody that's never done violence before, an impact weapon is always easier to use than an edged weapon.
What's an edge weapon?
An edge weapon being like a knife, a sword, something like that. Now, a hatchet's still technically an edged weapon, but I'm thinking that there's a workaround in your brain. Remember that scene in, what is it, Gladiator, Russell Crowe, where they take him out and they're going to kill him? They ask for a clean death?
Yeah, I don't remember.
Okay, well, it's a minor scene. It's where they're going to execute him, and he says, give me a clean death. Well, in Roman words, what that means is stab me. Don't slice me. Because that was one of the biggest things that the Roman army did better than everybody else, is they psychologically got their guys to deliver penetrating wounds instead of slashing wounds. Now, why is that important? Because it allows you to kill somebody by hitting a major organ with a penetrating wound than it is, however horrific it might be, a slashing wound, even with a sword, even with something humongous like that. Now, why did they have to work so hard from the psychological angle to get their guys to be willing to do that? And why could they do it better than anybody else? Well, there's actually like all this like weird hang-up stuff. And I would kind of have to believe David Grossman when he says that most people won't deliver a penetrating wound with like a knife because psychologically it's like it's almost like mixing like sex and violence in a way that like your human brain doesn't really like to do. And that, I mean, it makes logical sense. Now, can you overcome that with, I don't know, 6 months of knife work? Yeah, you don't have 6 months of knife work. So let's stick to the impact thing. So that's where you're going to get the hatchet. It's a lot closer to like an impact weapon, even though it's sharp. Other than that, I mean, you are going to have to do something to train yourself. And I would recommend like MMA, go to a boxing gym. I mean, boxers are fantastic fighters. Now, are there weaknesses that a boxer brings to a street fight? Sure. Like, they don't ever throw kicks at each other or do take whatever. Still, having 2 months of boxing experience is something that it helps you immediately and probably translates well enough. I mean, one nice thing about either boxing or MMA or kickboxing, you do get better like moment number one. Like, you're going to go and they're going to show you the right way to throw a punch, and you might even throw a couple at somebody else. You're not like a million times better, but you're like, you know, you're that much better. And every time you keep going to class, you keep getting better. So, I mean, learning how to fight is a huge deal, even if it's just a little bit. Even learning how to fight just a little bit.
And then what I always wonder is, why do you think things got so polarized so quickly? Like, even if you go back 10 years or 9 years to the 2012 elections, Obama versus Romney, I feel like you could have felt strongly about one side or the other,
yeah,
but you could still have discussions about it. Like, you could still talk to people who supported the other side, and you would say, okay, I see what you're saying, but I'm going to go with this guy. He seems like right. X, Y, and Z.
Oh, I agree. Absolutely. In fact, I just wrote a piece about this on my blog. I mean, even if you didn't like Obama, like, he could give a speech, man. It was hard to watch one of Obama's speeches, no matter how much you disliked him and not like him a little bit. Cause like, he was just really talented at giving speeches. He was great at it. And he kind of had that way of like mesmerizing a crowd that you see amongst really good politicians. How did it get so polarized? Without like really putting my tinfoil hat on, but kind of putting my tinfoil hat on, it really does feel like there was this kind of like globalist conspiracy to like push things in a certain direction. And I mean, that's really the only way I can explain it. There's no way the thing should have gotten so polarized in such a short period of time. I mean, to me, it's even weird that like communism is like the thing that we're fighting against right now. Like, I thought communism was dead in like 1988. I haven't thought about communism again since like they stopped making action movies about communism in like 1991. I had no idea that it was like a recovering ideology and was so like widely, loved. And that's crazy to me.
Yeah. I mean, you even look at just history, it's never worked in any country. And there's a reason, there's an economic reason for it, is that the price, if you give up profits in a company, the price you pay for that is inefficiency.
Right.
So when a competitor comes in who's more efficient than you, and so they're able to squeeze out more with less, you have to get more efficient in order to generate profits or you'll go out of business. So if you have all these competing companies getting more and more efficient versus countries where there's no profits, so they never have to fight for efficiency, That's why you see Soviet cars compared with U.S. cars or Japanese cars. There was a huge difference in the 80s.
You can actually look back even further in time, too. There was one colony of like Quakers or whatever in the early 1700s that decided when they founded their little colony, whatever, they're like, hey, man, here's what we're going to do. Everything we get, we're going to put in a communal storehouse. Everything's going to be groovy. They were like the first hippies ever, you know, like even with their little, you know, weird buckles and stuff. And their first year, they almost starved to death because with no incentive of like, this is my stuff. And if I have excess, even I can sell it and I'm going to make a better life for my family's kind of thing. Nobody wanted to work. That's communism in a nutshell. Like if nobody wants to work, if there's no incentive to work harder, who's going to?
Yeah. I mean, do you think that's why there's so many people who are not at work right now? Like, yeah, you go to a restaurant at half staff.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I mean, we're seeing it big time here. Every business in, like, the next three counties has, you know, hiring signs, like, please, like, we need help. And a lot of those at, you know, significantly above, you know, minimum wage for the kind of job that it is. And they cannot find people. And, I mean, it does make a lot of sense. I mean, if you're getting $600 a week in unemployment, or you can go work at the truck stop down the street for $400 a week, which one are you going to do?
Yeah. And or if you just sit at home and do nothing.
Well, that's what I mean. That's where the $600 a week comes from. That's what the unemployment benefit was for a while. Whereas, where's the work out to? A $10 an hour worker makes $400 a week before taxes.
I mean, I was very confused about all this during the economic lockdowns, which the government was enforcing. You sort of had to pay people to not work because people wanted to go to work.
Right.
But if you pay too much, I mean, I even had these discussions with, you know, the Larry Kudlow, who was the nation's economic advisor. Like, there's a fine line between supporting the people you're asking to shut down, and they don't, even though they don't want to, and then and giving too much so that people just totally back off from working.
Right. And, you know, it would also, I think, for a lot of these people that had those kind of low-paying jobs, I mean, it'd be really, if you took a year off, like if you had some job that sucked, but that was what you had and it was just barely making it, and you got to take a year off and, like, do whatever you wanted, really. Like, it would be really hard to go back to that, you know, kind of bullshit job. And, yeah, it'd be rough.
So these are some of the things I think that are probably contributing to the ideas that maybe there could be problems down the road. Like, what do you think? Like, you're neck deep in this stuff. Like, what do you think are the odds of a so-called Civil War II or some problem that, you know, is scary? Given the fact also that most Americans are pretty lazy and don't want anything bad to happen.
That's actually my that's actually what tempers my my belief that there will be one. Because most people are too lazy to get involved. I mean, that is just the bottom line. There's a huge percentage of people that are like, can I like watch this on pay-per-view? Like, nah, okay, then I'm not going. I'm not participating. And that's actually kind of sad in a way too. Because there's also, I mean, a pretty significant percentage of people that would just let like the government like stand on their neck with a jackboot rather than do something. So I'm going to call it like 70-30. With the 30 being the Civil War part, I say 70 against 30% for, which is still high odds. I mean, those are really, really high odds, higher than I would like them to be. Because like 3 years ago, 4 years ago, let's say 5 years ago, before the Donald Trump era, those odds were like 95 not going to happen and like 5 going to happen.
Right.
And if it was the 5, it had to be like influenced by somebody outside too. Like there had to be some kind of like crazy event to make it happen. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think it's great odds, but I think it actually goes up every day. And, I mean, we can see some crazy things, too. Like, I think there's a huge number of people right now that are not going bananas because they still think that we can fix this through an electoral process. And if the 2022 election has the same kind of shenanigans that the 2020 election had, I think that changes the odds significantly. I think you could see some fireworks after that.
So, you know, it's interesting again. Like, I feel like this is almost like a prequel to The Matrix. Like the Matrix movies never had a prequel. And I could just imagine, though, that it being like this, where, okay, everybody's told to stay at home. And then suddenly the biggest companies in the world are saying, hey, instead of staying home, why don't you come into this metaverse that we're building, like this virtual reality thing? It's going to be a lot of fun for everybody. And it just seems like this is how a prequel, I would write a prequel to The Matrix, is like right, this.
Right. So like you go into the metaverse and you actually pass out on your couch, and then here comes the Facebook moving truck. It pulls up in front of your house, comes in, puts you in a cocoon, carries you out. Yeah, bam, yeah, we're in The Matrix. Yeah.
Yeah, where you live, it's a better life anyway, right, being in right. The metaverse.
That was in the fine print of the contract you didn't read. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, man. I mean, that's possible. It's a very good point. You know, the other thing is, like, you got to look at what's happening in Australia and Europe. Like, they're way crazier than we are right now. And you got to wonder, are those same kind of lockdowns and vaccine mandates and stuff coming here? And, you know, will our people really put up with that? As much as Americans are lazy and soft, like, they also have, like, a strong history of rebellion. Like there are things, I mean, that's built into our DNA. And they are also, you know, armed to the teeth. So
yeah,
those are both wild cards.
Now, you mentioned in the book you've done some private security work. Like you had, you know, clients in, you know, Montana or wherever they were there. You mentioned some rich clients that had to kind of appease the neighbors so as not to get them all upset. But do people really need private security? Like who actually needs private security? I can't imagine, other than like a celebrity who doesn't want to be harassed in the middle of the street in LA, like does someone need private security in their home all the time?
I'll tell you something that I never told them because they were signing my paycheck, and that's just how it is. In a real like no shit, like things have gone terribly bad, your private security is either going to leave to protect their own family or cut your head off in your sleep and then take over your compound for their family. That's just kind of the the way that these things go. Like all these dudes, like you know, celebrities or you know Bill Gates or anybody else that has like a massive amount of money and therefore needs private security now, in a real like crisis event, it's not going to work out. The only people that are going to be able to have private armies at that point are like you know warlords. Like odds are the person that will be you know sitting in Bill Gates' compound if that actually goes down is whoever the toughest guy was that was on his security detail. Like his equivalent to like a colonel right now will be sitting in the big chair with the downflow of security goons.
Right. Like if I was someone like Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos, I would be thinking, okay, my plan B or plan Z, whatever you want to call it, would be to change my appearance, figure out how to what is going to be valuable in terms of trading. And stock up on that in various locations around the country or the world, and get paperwork for another identity. Well, like that would be my plan Z.
I would have a bunch of like dudes that are like gangsters around, but I would do more than just pay them. I would hang out with them. I would build like a personal relationship so that they didn't want to cut my head off when push came to shove. And, you know, I would also build a plan where I brought them in like, here's what we're going to do. We are going to have a bunch of stuff to trade and protect us. That's how you keep yourself alive in a situation like that. That's like Green Beret 101. Like, okay, well, if there's going to be an insurgency, well, I'm going to have the biggest insurgent team.
Yeah, so interesting. Well, you know, Clay Martin, author of Prairie Fire, Guidebook for Surviving Civil War II and Concrete Jungle, A Green Beret's Guide to Urban Survival. This is all so interesting because of the fact that we are having this conversation.
It's nuts. Like you said, 3-4 years ago, this would be like some lunatic, like I don't even want to talk. This is so crazy. And now, I mean, it's mainstream, like, you know, people are talking about this over their dinner tables. Is that it looks more and more like it's happening. I mean, they're putting up blast balls around the White House right now. Have you seen that?
No.
Yeah, starting last night, they've been bringing in those pre-made concrete barriers, the big ones. I mean, the big bastards, like the stop rockets that we had overseas. And they're building a blast wall around the White House right now, which is, I mean, it's disconcerting. Like that's
Why do you think they're doing that? Why is it starting now?
I mean, I have absolutely no idea.
Still
know? The popular sentiment on like Twitter today is the only reason they're doing this is they're planning on doing something that you're really not going to like, which makes sense. But I mean, I don't know. I mean, for all I know, they know there's a protest scheduled for Washington D.C. or some kind of riot or something. But it's definitely something that's kind of without precedent, something that I've never seen before, and it's concerning.
Well, look. If I show up at your place in the middle of the night, like, hey,
I got you, man.
Hey, Clay,
I got you.
I could fix your computer, and I don't even know if I could do that, to be honest. I could write a blog post.
Can you bring Jay the engineer to fix my computer? In that case, you're cool.
I could bring Jay's with me. He's not going to cut off my head, I don't think. So,
well, you know, and really, I mean, I think we have time. You know, figure out something that you can do in an environment where there's no electricity. And work on that. I mean, it could be as simple. I mean, you're an entertaining dude. I tell my friend Jesse Kelly this all the time. Like, he's going to survive the jihad because we've got to have somebody around to keep us entertained. Like, that's cool.
Yeah, he's a funny guy.
He is a funny guy. Like, well, hey, man, you're fine, brother. But, I mean, everybody should be working on their skills right now. Like, this is the training time. This is the montage, and the title fight's coming up, maybe. So be ready for it.
Well, thank you very much, Clay. And come on again, and I'm going to try to get ready, and we'll see if I'm improving.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.